Darwin thought to explain the origin of various secondary sexual characteristics, such as ornamentation and color of feathers in birds, by saying that they were the results of gradual selection, through many generations, of traits attractive in the eyes of the female. But it was shown that when the colorful wings of male butterflies were cut off and in their stead female wings, often without the characteristic coloring, were glued to the body of the male butterfly, the female did not object to the approach of the male. She failed to discriminate against male butterflies with no wings at all. Also, it was observed that some male fish fertilize the fish eggs, having all the male coloring characteristic of such season, but without the female fish being present or aware of the act of fertilization. The theory of sexual selection to a certain degree had the same fate as the theory of gem, mules. But the theory of natural selection would not yield its position unless a better explanation of the evolutionary mechanism could be given. Mutations and new species. The first ray of light came at the turn of the century, when Hugo de Vries, a Dutch botanist, observed spontaneous mutations in the evening primrose. The plant, without a recognizable cause, would show new characteristics unobserved in its ancestors. Although de Vries claimed that these mutations amount to what may be called little species, they have not caused the primrose to pass beyond the frontier of its species. However, it was demonstrated that variations within a species do appear in a spontaneous manner, and rather suddenly, and not, as Darwin thought, by minute progressions from generation to generation. Huxley was correct in urging Darwin not to adhere so dogmatically to his belief that nature does not make jumps, natura non facit saltum. De Vries showed that variations are in the nature of jumps, and from this he developed the mutation theory of evolution. De Vries, while working on his theory, was as yet unaware of Gregor Mendel's investigations in genetics, already published as a paper in 1865. Only 6 years after The Origin of Species. Mendel's work, unknown to Darwin and his followers in the 19th century, was rediscovered by de Vries and independently by E. Ter, and by K. Kerens in 1900, the same year that de Vries wrote down his theory of mutations. By carefully observing crossings between varieties of the garden pea and counting the strains through consecutive generations and the transmission of single traits, Mendel established the fundamental laws of genetics or inheritance of somatic characteristics. The entire work on evolution since the beginning of this century is based on genetics and Mendel's laws. Ironically, Mendel was an Augustine monk and made his basic contribution at a time when the war between science and the church was raging, following the publication of Darwin's main work. The spontaneous variations in mutants can be followed through as hereditary factors in successive generations of offspring. The genes in the germ plasma are the carriers of the traits, and a variation, mutation, in a gene would cause a variation, mutation, in the offspring. But, generally, only single variations appear at a time. They may lead to new races, not to new species. Spontaneous mutations are far too few and insufficient in magnitude to bring about the appearance of new species and to explain how the world of animals came into existence. Despite all spontaneous variations, no new species of mammals are known to have been created since the close of the Ice Age. In 1907, Kellogg of Stanford University came to the following conclusion: the fair truth is that the Darwinian selection theories, considered with regard to their claimed capacity to be an independently sufficient mechanical explanation of descent, stand today seriously discredited in the biological world. On the other hand, it is also fair truth to say that no replacing hypothesis or theory of species forming has been offered by the opponents of selection which has met with any general or even considerable acceptance by naturalists. Mutations seem to be too few and far between. For orthogenesis we can discover no satisfactory mechanism, and the same is true for the Lamarckian theories of modification by the accumulation, through inheritance, of acquired or ontogenic characters. Kellogg also observed that one group of scientists denies any effectiveness or capacity for species forming on the part of natural selection, while the other group, a larger, sees in natural selection an evolutionary factor capable of initiating nothing, dependent wholly for any effectiveness on some primary factor or factors controlling the origin and direction of variation, but capable of extinguishing all unadapted, unfit lines of development. For my part, Kellogg concluded, it seems better to go back to the old and safe ignoramus standpoint. Thus the entire problem was shunted back to the place it occupied before the origin of species. Evolution is the principle. Darwin's contribution to the principle is natural selection as the mechanism of evolution. If natural selection, sharing the fate of sexual selection, is not the mechanism of the origin of species, Darwin's contribution is reduced to very little, only to the role of natural selection in weeding out the unfit. H. Fairfield Osborne, a leading American evolutionist, wrote, "In contrast to the unity of opinion on the law of evolution is the wide diversity of opinion on the causes of evolution. In fact, the causes of the evolution of life are as mysterious as the law of evolution is certain." And again, it may be said that Darwin's law of selection as a natural explanation of the origin of ill-fitness in form and function has also lost its prestige at the present time. And all of Darwinism which now meets with universal acceptance is the law of the survival of the fittest, a limited application of Darwin's great idea as expressed by Herbert Spencer. These were not the opinions of single evolutionists, but generally held views. William Bateson, a leading English evolutionist, in his address before the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 1921, said, "When students of other sciences ask us what is now currently believed about the origin of species, we have no clear answer to give. Faith has given place to agnosticism. Variation of many kinds, often considerable, we daily witness, but no origin of species. I have put before you very frankly the considerations which have made us agnostic as to the actual mode and processes of evolution. Nor, in a series of guest lectures delivered at Princeton University, asked, if natural selection is a force which can destroy but cannot create species and if the reasons for this destruction are unknown, of what value is the theory to mankind? The collapse of the theory of natural selection leaves the philosophy of mechanistic materialism in a sorry plight. Under Verise's theory of evolution by mutations, Moore said, the idea is destructive to scientific theory, as it really does away with the whole idea of continuity which should be the basis of an evolution theory. The thought at once occurs that each of the surprising breaks in the paleontological record, such an one as separates the reptile from the feathered bird, may have been taken at a single leap during an overstimulated period of nature. De Vries made observations of spontaneous mutations in plants. A decade later, X. H. Morgan found spontaneous mutations in Drosophilae, the vinegar fly, including various colorings of the eyes and various lengths of wings, and many other changes in progeny not present in any of the ancestors. H. J. Muller, by subjecting the vinegar fly to the action of X rays, increased the frequency of mutations 150 times. It was also found that some chemicals and temperatures close to the limits that the insect organism can endure may act as mutation-provoking agents. Muller concluded that spontaneous mutations are usually due to an accidental individual molecular or submolecular collision, occurring in the course of thermal agitation, and this is indicated by the amount of rise in the frequency of mutations that is observed when the temperature is raised, so long as temperatures normal to the organism are not transgressed. Since chemical changes similar to but more extreme than those of thermal agitation may also be produced by X rays and other high energy radiation and by ultraviolet, it is not surprising that mutations like the so-called spontaneous ones can be induced in great abundance by these means, and that the number of these mutations is, in general, proportional to the number of physical hits caused by the radiation. The origin of mutations in the evening primrose, observed by De Vries, like every other spontaneous mutation, must be ascribed to one of those irritants acting directly on the genes. It could have been the result of hits by cosmic rays, only it must be shown why the evening primrose is more susceptible to such an agent than most other plants. The practical absence of X Rays in surrounding nature caused this powerful agent of mutations in laboratories to be regarded as not operative in spontaneous mutations and therefore also not in the process of evolution. Muller stressed this point. However, an X-ray component is present in radium radiation. At the beginning of the present century, it was noticed that tadpoles or embryonic frogs in the presence of a tube containing radium give rise to various freaks. Radioactivity and cosmic radiation are agents present in nature, one of terrestrial, the other of extraterrestrial, origin. If, as the experiments with the vinegar fly demonstrated, a mutation of some gene can produce a wingless fly, many mutations simultaneously or in quick succession would be quite able to transform an animal or plant into a new species. In the bomb craters of London, new plants, not previously known on the British Isles, and possibly not known anywhere, were seen to sprout. Rare plants, unknown to modern British botany, were discovered in the bomb craters and ruins of London in 1943. It appears that the thermal action of bomb explosions was the cause of multiple metamorphoses in the genes of seeds and pollens. If this is so, then the statement made earlier that no new species has been observed in the process of making its first appearance must be retracted. It must be retracted anyway, so far as the plant, not animal, kingdom is concerned, in view of the claims made by a certain school of plant geneticists that now and then some plants may produce an abnormal offspring with a double number of chromosomes and, further, that, though hybrids in plants, as in animals, generally have no offspring, hybrids from the double chromosome parents may occasionally produce a true new species. It can reproduce itself indefinitely, but it cannot reproduce by crossing with the original species, or if it does, the offspring resulting from the crossbreeding is sterile. An alkaloid, colchicin, from the roots of the autumn crocus, when applied to cells in the process of division, helps to produce cells with twice the normal number of chromosomes. Thus a fertile cross between the radish and the cabbage was achieved, and the proponents of cataclysmic evolution claim that chance appearance of double chromosome plants was responsible in the past for the origin of cultivated wheat, oats, sugar cane, cotton, and tobacco, and will permit production in the laboratory of a gram that would combine the desirable qualities of both wheat and rye. What causes a plant to produce spontaneously an offspring with a double number of chromosomes is not yet sufficiently known, and the most probably, again, thermal, chemical, or radioactive agents are involved. Cataclysmic evolution. When, therefore, the earth, covered with mud from the recent flood, became heated up by the hot and genial rays of the sun, she brought forth innumerable forms of life, in part of ancient shapes, and in part creatures new and strange. An enormous expansion of radioactivity in bygone ages was postulated by various theorists as an explanation of great oscillations in climate in the past. The thermal effect of widespread radioactivity is likewise claimed as a motive force by the author of the modern version of the theory of drifting continents, Du Toit. It appears to me that if such radioactivity really occurred, its mutation effect could not have failed to take place too. Cosmic rays or charges, hitting nitrogen atoms in the atmosphere, transform this element into radiocarbon. These charges, arriving from outside the Earth, a very strong per particle, averaging several billions of electron volts and sometimes carrying a potential of 100 billion electron volts. As comparatively few such rays or charges hit our atmosphere, their general effect is not spectacular. But it is conceivable that, where a cosmic ray or charge hits a gene of germ plasma, a biological mutation takes place, comparable to the physical transmutation of the elements. After all, the genes, like any proteins, are biochemical compounds composed of carbon, nitrogen, and a few other elements. Should a somatic chromosome be hit by a powerful charge, it might at worst cause disorganized growth and be the origin of a neoplasma, but if the genes of the germ plasma should be the target of a collision with a cosmic ray or secondary radiation, a mutation in the progeny might ensue, and should many such hits occur, the origin of a new species, most probably incapable of individual or genetic life, but in some cases capable, could be expected. Thus, increased radioactivity coming from outside this planet or from the bowels of the Earth could be the cause of the spontaneous origin of new species. Should an interplanetary discharge take place between the Earth and another celestial body, such as a planet, a planetoid, a trail of meteorites, or a charged cloud of gases, with possibly billions of volts of potential difference and nuclear fission or fusion, the effect would be similar to that of an explosion of many hydrogen bombs with ensuing procreation of monstrosities and growth anomalies on a large scale. What matters is that the principle that can cause the origin of species exists in nature. The irony lies in the circumstance that Darwin saw in catastrophism the chief adversary of his theory of the origin of species, being led by the conviction that new species could evolve as a result of competition with accidental characteristics serving as weapons only if almost limitless time were at the disposal of that competition, with no catastrophes intervening. Now exactly the opposite is true. Competition cannot cause new species to evolve. Mutations in single traits and the resulting new varieties within a species are caused by radiation hitting some gene, as did the X rays in the experiments on the vinegar fly. It is a hit, or a collision, or a miniature catastrophe. In order for a simultaneous mutation of many characteristics to occur, with a new species as a resultant, a radiation shower of terrestrial or extraterrestrial origin must take place. Therefore, we are led to the belief that evolution is a process initiated in catastrophes. Numerous catastrophes or bursts of effective radiation must have taken place in the geological past in order to change so radically the living forms on Earth, as the record of fossils embedded in lava and sediment bears witness. How would this understanding of evolution meet the facts, and especially those facts that always appeared to be in discord with the theory of natural selection? The fact that some organisms, like Foraminifera, survived all geological ages without participating in evolution, a point of perplexity in the theory of natural selection, would be explained by catastrophic evolution in which many species would be destroyed, others would be subjected to multiple mutations, and some specimens of species would escape mutations and procreate their old form. The fact that the geological record shows a sudden emergence of many new forms at the beginning of each geological age does not require the artificial explanation that the records are always defective. The geological records truly reflect the changes in the animal and plant worlds from one period of geological time to the next. Many of the new species evolved in the wake of a global catastrophe, at the beginning of a new age, were entombed in a subsequent paroxysm of nature at the end of that age. The fact that in many cases the intermediary links between present-day species are missing, as well as those between various species of the geological record, a vexing problem, is understandable in the light of sudden and multiple variations that gave rise to new species. It was objected that if a new characteristic appeared in only a single animal, as the theory of natural selection claims, or even in a few animals of the same species, it would disappear in succeeding generations through interbreeding unless the new animal had been protected by isolation on secluded islands. However, in catastrophic evolution, the simultaneous mutation of many genes could produce a new species at the first fertilization. All the offspring of a litter could be affected similarly. And it is not inconceivable that in more than one creature of the same species, under similar circumstances of radiation, similar changes in the genes would occur. So in the X-ray experiments on Drosophila, similar mutations occurred in more than one fly. The objection to the theory of natural selection, that the developed plan in a new species must appear suddenly or the race would expire, as in the case of the kangaroo pockets, is answerable within the framework of catastrophic evolution. However, the purposefulness of animal structures will remain a problem deserving of as much wonder as, for instance, the purposeful behavior of leukocytes in the blood that rush to combat a noxious intruder. The fact stressed by Agassiz that numerous earlier species of fish showed a more highly developed organism when compared with later species of fish can be explained by the destruction of earlier forms, not in the process of competition, but in upheavals against which superior structure is no defense. The observation that healthy species of animals, like mammoths, with no sign of degeneration suddenly became extinct greatly troubled the evolutionists. This fact is unexplainable by natural selection or the principle of competition, not so by the catastrophic intervention of nature. The fact that at several stages of the past many animals of various species and many species in total were rather suddenly exterminated, in conflict with the idea of slow extinction in natural selection, conforms with the theory of cataclysmic evolution. The enigmatic observation that the larger animals were particularly subject to extinction, the giant mammals that succumbed at the end of the tertiary, and again in the Pleistocene, as earlier the dinosaurs did, is comprehensible if one thinks of the better chances smaller animals have of finding refuge from the ravages of nature. Natural selection had its role, too, but not in procreating new species. It was a decisive factor in the survival or dying out of new forms, in the struggle for existence, not only between individuals, races, species, and orders, but also against the elements. In natural selection, all those forms were weeded out that could not meet competition or the rapidly changing conditions of a world in upheaval. The origin of new species from old could be caused by the processes that can be duplicated in laboratories, by excessive radiation or some other irritant in abnormal doses, thermal or chemical, all of which must have taken part in natural catastrophes of the past, and could have played a role in building new species, as the case of new plants in the bomb craters appears to indicate. The theory of evolution is vindicated by catastrophic events in the Earth's past. The proclaimed enemy of this theory proved to be its only ally. The real enemy of the theory of evolution is the teaching of uniformity, or the non-occurrence of any extraordinary events in the past. This teaching, called by Darwin the mainstay of the theory of evolution, almost set the theory apart from reality. Great catastrophes of the past accompanied by electrical discharges and followed by radioactivity could have produced sudden and multiple mutations of the kind achieved today by experimenters, but on an immense scale. The past of mankind, and of the animal and plant kingdoms, too, must now be viewed in the light of the experience of Hiroshima and no longer from the portholes of the Beagle. Chapter 16, The End. In the present book the testimony of stone and bone has been written down. We have listened to witnesses of various epochs, old and recent, of different latitudes, north and south, of various origins, from mountain peak and ocean bottom, skeletons, and ashes, and lava. Long before the crowd of witnesses finished filing by, we knew that we would not be able to evade the conclusion that global catastrophes have shaken this world of ours. I have not included here the testimony of ancient literary sources or of folklore. Shall I be confronted with the argument that, though the geological and archaeological records speak for catastrophic occurrences in the past, the absence of human testimony contradicts this interpretation of the geological record of recent date? Is not Worlds in Collision a book of human evidence? And was not this testimony disputed because, first of all, of a presumed conflict with the findings of geology? Although no references to historical inscriptions or to literary monuments of ancient times have been adduced here to show correspondence between the geological and historical records, no attentive reader, not even a cursory peruser of these pages, could have read them without associating their content with that of many chapters of Worlds in Collision, if he had read the other book too. There the story was told of hurricanes of global magnitude, of forests burning and swept away, of dust, stones, fire, and ashes falling from the sky, of mountains melting like wax, of lava flowing from riven ground, of boiling seas, of bituminous rain, of shaking ground and destroyed cities, of humans seeking refuge in caverns and fissures of the rock in the mountains, of oceans upheaved and falling on the land, of tidal waves moving toward the poles and back, of land becoming sea by submersion and the expanse of sea turning into desert, islands born and others drowned, mountain ridges leveled and others rising, of crowds of rivers seeking new beds, of sources that disappeared and others that became bitter, of great destructions in the animal kingdom, of decimated mankind, of migrations, of heavy clouds of dust covering the face of the earth for decades, of magnetic disturbances, of changed climates, of displaced cardinal points and altered latitudes, of disrupted calendars, and of sundials and water clocks that point to changed length of day, month, and year, of a new polar star. All this was presented in Worlds in Collision as having taken place in two series of events, the first in the 15th century before the present era, or 34 centuries ago, the other, of lesser intensity, in the 8th century and the beginning of the 7th, 27 centuries ago. Events of a similar nature and on an even more grandiose scale took place also in earlier ages. The narration of some of these events, as far as the human memory retained their recollection, is reserved for another volume, a sequel to Worlds in Collision. Wherever we investigate the geological and paleontological records of this earth, we find signs of catastrophes and upheavals, old and recent. Mountains sprang from plains, and other mountains were leveled, strata of the terrestrial crust were folded and pressed together and overturned and moved and put on top of other formations, igneous rock melted and flooded enormous areas of land with miles, thick sheets, the ocean bed flowed with molten rock. Ashes showered down and built layers many yards thick on the ground and on the bottom of the oceans in their vast expanse. Shores of ancient lakes were tilted and are no longer horizontal. Seacoasts show subsidence or emergence, in some places over 1,000 feet. Rocks of the earth are filled with remains of life extinguished in a state of agony. Sedimentary rocks are one vast graveyard, and the granite and basalt, too, have embedded in them numberless living organisms, and shells have closed valves as they do in a living state, so unexpectedly came the interment. And vast forests were burned and washed away and covered with the waters of the seas and with sand and turned to coal, and animals were swept to the far north and thrown into heaps and were soaked by bituminous outpourings, and broken bones and torn ligaments and the skins of animals of living species and extinct were smashed together with splintered forests into huge piles, and whales were cast out of the oceans onto mountains, and rocks from disintegrating mountain ridges were carried over vast stretches of land, from Norway to the Carpathians, and into the Harz Mountains, and into Scotland, and from Mount Blanc to the Juras, and from Labrador to the Po, Connors, and the Rocky Mountains moved many leagues from their place, and the Alps travelled 100 miles northward, and the Himalayas and the Andes climbed ever higher, and the mountain lakes emptied themselves over barriers. And continents were torn by rifts, and the sea bottom by canyons, and land disappeared under the sea, and the sea pushed new islands from its bottom, and seabeds were turned into high mountains bearing seashells, and shoals of fish were poisoned and boiled in the seas, and numberless rivers lost their channels, were dammed by lava and turned upstream, and the climate suddenly changed, tillable land and meadows turned into vast deserts. Reindeer from Lapland and polar fox and Arctic bears from the snowy tundras and rhinoceroses and hippopotami from the African jungles, and lions from the desert and ostriches, and seals, were thrown into piles and covered with gravel, clay, and tuff, and the fissures of multitudes of rocks arc filled with broken bones, regions where the palm grew were moved into the Arctic, and oceans steamed, and the evaporated seas condensed under clouds of dust and built mountainous covers of ice over great stretches of continents, and the ice melted on heated ground and cast icebergs into the oceans in enormous fleets, and all volcanoes erupted, and all human dwellings were shattered and burned, and animals tame and fierce and human beings with them ran for refuge to mountain caves, and mountains swallowed and entombed those that reached the refuge, and many species and genera and families of the animal kingdom were annihilated down to the very last one, and the earth and the sea and the sky again and again united their elements in one great work of destruction. Following the trail of geology, we were led by the merciless logic of facts and figures to the conclusion that the earth was more than once a stage on which acts of a great drama took place, and no place on earth was free of its effects. In the face of the evidence, we were also compelled to concede that the most recent paroxysms of nature happened in historical times, only a few thousand years ago, when in some parts of the world civilization was already entering the Iron Age, but in other parts still lingering in the Neolithic or even in the Paleolithic, or Rude Stone, age. The laminations of lakes, the silt content of those without outflow, the retreat of waterfalls, the elevation of mountains, pollen analysis, and archaeological finds, as well as the recent drop of the ocean level, all show how close to our time must have occurred the more recent paroxysms of nature.